Accession number 18473, Reel 1.
David Machida, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Burniston, North Yorkshire.
I think you said that's part of Scarborough?
It's quite close to Scarborough. It's almost a suburb of Scarborough now.
Which year was this?
That's in 1938.
Did you grow up in the Scarborough area?
No. I was born in 1938. Hitler was having a bit of a thrash around, and Dad thought it was wise, with the advent of war probably, that we moved to the Derbyshire area, where Mum's parents came from, so that in the event of him going to war, his wife and we kids would be near relatives.
Do you remember anything about the Second World War?
Oh, good heavens, yes. I can remember Churchill talking on the radio. I can remember his famous, one of his famous speeches about Hitler. Hitler said he's going to wring England's neck like a chicken. And I can remember Churchill replying, some chicken, some neck. But no, I can remember the war. I remember the maps on the paper in the papers. No names, but just little arrows moving, you know, our troops are here with me.
Did the war affect you in any way at all? Any bombing or anything of that?
No, I was in Derbyshire at the time, so far enough away from bombing. Funnily enough, we used to go to for holidays in Kent, down Kemsing. And one year down there was some bombs jettisoned, and they hit the hillside quite close to where we were. Mum and her sister we were stopping with obviously thought we kids had heard them, and they went up for a walk, took us for a walk, and they went up ahead of us and buried sweets in the bomb craters, and suggested that we have a look around there, see if we could find anything. Of course, we found these toffees in there, and oh, and the Germans nicely dropped toffees for you, which is strange, because Mum always said, never pick anything up and eat it, because the Germans might have dropped poison down. So it's a bit of a conflict there.
Now, how did you come to be in the Navy yourself?
I was told when I was at school that the careers man was coming round. Up to that point, I never thought of anything other than school. I didn't know what to do after school or anything. And come my turn to be interviewed, he said, what do you want to be? And the only thing that flashed through my mind was that Dad always called me captain. And from that, I said, Royal Navy. And lo and behold, within a few weeks, there's a letter at home waiting for me to go to the recruiting office in Derby and do the exam for Navy. And September the 8th, 1953, I was on my way.
Where did you do the basic training?
That basic training was at Shotley Gate, near Felixstowe, HMS Ganges. I can remember the journey down there on the train. I think ignorance is bliss is a good term, because there was a lot of us boarding the train with cases, all in plain clothes, best suits and what have you, and all full of bliss because we didn't know what was ahead of us. But then also on the train was the old sailors with HMS Ganges on the hats and in uniform, and we could listen to all the stories they were telling, and we didn't really know what we were going for. But the first sight of Ganges was a 142-foot white mast, and that was in the main part of Ganges. We, of course, as new entrants, went to the annex, away from the main part, to be kitted out, shouted at, and generally learn drill and what have you. Saw our names in clothing. Then a month later, we marched across to the main part of Ganges, joined that, had Sunday divisions, inspected, marched past, and was incorporated in it. I have some terrible memories of Ganges. I have heard it described as a hell on earth. And it could at the time, of course, that was a Navy and I knew no better. But in on reflection and now, I realise that it was a hell on earth. There was still at that time, I'm almost certain, whippings. I never saw one. We've never done in public. I never saw one. But I do recall a boy hauled up in front of some of the divisions, dressed in a duck suit. I don't mean with a bill and a fluffy tail. I mean a duck with a sailcloth. And his punishment was read out, and I'm sure that it was so many strokes of the cane, and then he was hauled away. And I've inquired since of people around that time who were in Ganges, and he says, yes, oh yes, the cane was still in use. The petty officers, instructors, the chiefs, I think most of them had a sadistic streak. I remember one retired Marine who was in charge of the laundry in the annex part when we first went there, and he showed you how to wash clothes. And his favourite words were socks and soap on the shelf and collar and cuffs first, which you wash your cuffs first and your collar first on your shirt and then the rest. And if he didn't think you'd done it properly, it hit you with it, this wet shirt or wet trousers or whatever. But at that time we were only dressed in little swimming trunks, which were virtually two triangles of cloth joined up at the crotch, you know, two strings either side to put them on. I think seeing Japanese prisoner of war camp wearing them. And this is what we wore. And people turned blue because he kept whipping us with his bloody wet clothing. But he took seemed to take great enjoyment out of it. There were a lot of cruelties. In the main building itself, this damn mast we had to climb, 142 foot. To say that it was a bit daunting to start with was an understatement. You had to climb up the damn thing, and right at the very top, there's a portion where you had to sort of climb out at a 45 degree angle, so you were virtually hanging upside down. Then negotiate an angle back again. So it was a 90 degree angle you had to negotiate with this 142 foot drop beneath you. And it was very frightening. But you didn't come down again. You had to go up one side and come down the other. And there's no way would you come down the wrong side, because the petty officer at the bottom and it hit you. The winter times always stick out as well. There was what they call a crab inspection. It was a body lice inspection. And whilst we had showers in the or near the blocks where we lived, the mess decks, we had to go every month or thereabouts down to a special bath. We ran down there, maybe a quarter of a mile, ran down naked, grab a hat with a towel, and have a shower down there. And the petty officer on duty would inspect your crutch and armpits for lice, which was fine in summer. But in winter, down Ipswich, down Shotley Way, it is bloody freezing. And you can imagine running down there naked, quarter of a mile, early morning, with snow on the ground, frost. The first people in there used to get hot water. The last people in got cold, but you couldn't tell the difference because it felt hot, you were that cold. They had several punishments. The Faith, Hope and Charity was a set of three steps, and you had to double as a single person or as a squad up and down these steps till you dropped, very often carrying a dummy shell, which was what the shell itself was for, £75. You had to run up and down these steps with them. Or Laundry Hill was another one, which was a reasonably steep hill. You ran up and down this. When you're running up, the man from the back had to run to the front. And when he got to the front, the next man at the back ran to the front. So he was doing sort of twice the length of the hill. It was a hellish punishment. Bearing in mind we're 15 years old.
Did you get punished?
No, I was didn't get caught. Fortunately, I think we had a pretty good petty officer. We had two of them, one taught gunnery and one taught seamanship. P.O. Dan taught seamanship. But yeah, they were quite humane. I did remember the GI, that's a gunnery instructor, throwing a rifle at me. They weighed 7 pounds and it caught me on the thigh. And I think I limped around for about a month. But no, other than that, I never got punished. No. Oh, not singly, not individually. As a class, yeah, oh, good heavens, yeah. We developed the Shotley Shuffle. We ran round the parade ground. What wasn't the number of times you ran around it that counted, it was length of time. And you might be out there 2 or 3 hours. And to conserve energy, we developed this shuffle, a shuffling run. You sort of, big hobnail boots on, your feet never left the deck. and you just shuffled around, and this sound could be heard for miles. And if ever you heard it, you sort of think, oh, some poor bastards, haven't you? You know, and your heart went out to them, because you knew what, 2 or 3 hours they'd be running around this damn parade ground. But funnily enough, I have been back since the Ganges. The mast's still there. But there's a strange attraction to it. You've got to go back. A lot of people have said this who've been to Ganges. They've got to go back, and I think they're very proud of being there. I know I was. It's a making of me, I think.
In what sense?
It taught me a lot of discipline. I came from an isolated country village, and I was really left to my own devices. Mum and Dad, don't get me wrong, Mum and Dad were great. But I had no real discipline. I got into Ganges, and I think he gave me reliance on fellow man. I think that's probably what it was designed for. That you became a team, which was what we required on a ship, of course. It was a camaraderie effect, I think. And I learned to wash clothes, which has stood me in good stead since, you know. And the mess decks had a parquet flooring, highly polished. And you're not allowed to sort of walk on that in boots or anything. It was always sock feet, and you shuffled across that as well to keep it highly polished. But the way you polished it was with a hairbrush on your hands and knees, and you went up and down this damn floor, parquet flooring. But no, it was harsh, a harsh life. But I'm thankful that I went through it. I really am.
Why did you throw the rifle at him?
I don't know. I did something wrong. I don't know what it was now. It's a number of years ago. He had my rifle, and I think a fit of temper. I think he just threw it back at me, and it just hit me on the thigh. It caused a big dent.
Did you report him?
No, he wouldn't do that. No. It would have been fatal. It would have been fatal to report anything like that. Because the repercussions would have been horrendous, not only for yourself, but for everyone. No one ever reported anything like that. It was just not done. Not because you didn't want to get the person into trouble, but because of the respect for your own classmates, your own messmates, because you knew damn well that they get punished as well.
Did anybody ever run away?
Oh, heavens, yes. Yes. A lot of attempts to run away. There was a few people disappeared. They'd be there 1 minute, next minute they'd disappear. I don't mean they sort of got locked up or anything. I learnt later they had nervous breakdowns. And they were just suddenly sent away, I assume, to hospital. But yes, our people tried to run away, didn't get very far, and got sent back. They'd end up at divisions on the day after they probably went to cells, yes. So they had the punishment read out, and as deterrent. I suppose it's like the old days, putting the head of the traitor on the gate, on a pike, so.
Where did you go to after Ganges?
I went to a fantastic place, fantastic ship, HMS Comet. It was built about the same time as I was, 1938, and therefore it had been through the war. A lot of men had been through the war. This was, would be November, I think it was, 1954, or December 54. I have a strong recollection that it was in dry dock when we arrived. They'd already had a complement of men on board, and we arrived, we group of boys, I suppose about 30 boys went, and she was in dry dock. We joined about halfway through that commission, and I can remember now thinking how small it was, how narrow. And it was a damn good time to join that ship. As I said, the men had been through the war, and it was that camaraderie still there. And Malta itself, that was a hell of an eye-opener, a cultural shock, I think. We obviously left dry dock, and we normally tied up in Salima Creek. I went to a buoy in Salima Creek, and so from the ship, we could see Salima itself, the township. We did catch a Daiso, the ship's Daiso, across when we were on leave, a shore leave. But that was a hot place, sandstone, very, very bright. I remember there was a lot of glare there. I remember seeing the man with the Daiso, he's the boatman who served our ship. He rowed a couple of oars, Mediterranean style. And I remember him sorting the gash out, the rubbish out. And he was sorting the bread out and all the foodstuffs that were sort of edible, putting it to one side. And one of the old race said that's for his family. And I thought, this is the first time I've sort of seen poverty on that basis. And it never occurred to me that anyone was that poor. And I always made a point then, when I ever took the gash down to him, I'd always wrap the foodstuffs up separate from the rest. And I don't know, I felt really very sorry for him. I never saw his family. I don't have many kids yet, but being Maltese, he probably had quite a lot. That was a great place, Malta. A good introduction to a foreign country. The Maltese liked the British. In fact, when it went independent, there was a lot of crying, a lot of sadness about in Malta. But that was years after. I remember going down the Gut, which the real name is Straight Street. As a boy, see, when I wasn't allowed to drink or not supposed to drink, but this was a street of bars. I think at the top was Egyptian Queen, and the Bing Crosby was at the bottom. And halfway down were the Seven Sisters. That's not a house of ill repute, it's a bar. But and the idea was to go from the top end and have a drink in every bar, right down to the bottom. I never did get to the bottom. I got to the part of the Seven Sisters. But I went down to the Mediterranean the second time as well, so I think it was on that occasion. I was a lot older. But Straight Street itself, or the Gut, as it was formerly known, carved in the side of it were little crosses. And that's, I was told, where the Knights of St. John in the old days had died. They'd had a duel or a fight, and they'd been killed there. There was a cross carved in the side of the wall. But no, sailed all around the Mediterranean. We sailed off towards Cyprus. The Navy, as long as I can remember, when I was in, you was never told anything. You never saw a newspaper, never heard the news, and anything you were told was on a need-to-know basis, and it was considered we didn't need to know, so we never got told anything. We sailed off towards Cyprus. And all of a sudden, one night, he was told to darken ship. That's all, the deadlights closed on the scuttles, no light showing outside, no smoking, nothing. And no noise, told to be quiet. And all of a sudden, there was this searchlight from the bridge, flashed on, straight onto what they call a kite. It's a local boat. And it was gunrunners. It was days of the Eoka terrorists. And these chaps were gunrunners into Cyprus. I remember, I can hear it now, someone say, the captain, I assume, after the watch, saying, put a shot across his bows. Why they never used a bow for a 40mm, I don't know, because it would have been obviously more effective. But they used a 303, and I don't think the person, the marksman with the 303, thought it would be too effective either, across the bow, so he put it through the wheelhouse. It shattered, nearly shot the helmsman, but he stopped the boat. But I remember also there's a box of dynamite on there, and I don't know why. I think he was probably the most hated rating on board. He was the dynamite itself was put in the sea boat in a whaler on the davits, and got ready for lowering, and the dynamite put in there, and this rating told to sit on it, and I don't know what he was supposed to do. I think the pins were out of the Robinson disengaging gear, and I think exploded. I think he was supposed to drop the whaler to save the ship, but why he was told to sit on it, I don't know. As I say, he must have been the most hated man on board. But we went into Farm Augusta, but then we put a boarding party on the kite, got the prisoners on board, and took me to Farm Augusta.
Is this 55?
It was around that time, must have been, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then, I went to Naples. That was a strange place, Naples. The very dirty bay. The Bay of Naples itself is has a very narrow neck to the sea. And I believe in the wartime, the Italian Navy was tied up alongside, that is, the side of the ship to the jetty. And they got bombed. And getting away from there, they caused all sorts of havoc. And eventually the ships did get bombed and blocked the harbour. So it became the law, harbour master's rules or whatever, that you went stern first. Your stern was against the jetty, and you had two anchors out either side to steady the ship. But when you pull the anchors back in again, the lot of mud smelt evil. They were hose pipes, racing with hose pipes, washing it off, but didn't get everything off. It used to dry in the cable locker. Well, I happened to be down the cable locker, and you coil the cable that came in as chain, anchor chain, in, and all this black ooze, evil smelling stuff was coming with it. Now you coil the chain down, the anchor cable down, but I've seen it go out. When you drop anchor, it whips round. I mean, you stand in the corner and cower because this bloody big thick cable is whipping round, and all this dirt, old mud that wasn't washed off, it comes flying around. Quite a dangerous place to be. No safety glasses, no safety helmet in them days. It was the quick and the dead, you know. But I've got fond memories of Naples. I was 17 when I went there. I went ashore with an oppo of mine. I can't remember who it was. I know we had no money. The exchange rate that was then was £1 was equal to 1,000 lira. And I think we had about 100 lira, which was nothing. And he wanted to go into a brothel. Well, I'd never been with a woman in my life at all. As for girlfriends, there was none where I lived as a boy. And he wanted to go to a brothel. Well, I went along with him because I was lost anyway. I didn't know where the hell I was. And he went off with his woman there, and then this woman, other woman came to me and started talking to me. You want to come with me, Johnny? I said, I've got no money. I think about 100 lira. I think it's about 10p, I'm not sure. And she insisted I go with her. I went in a timorous little boy and walked out bloody a man, you know. Didn't charge me anything. It was a strange thing. She certainly opened my eyes. I've never looked back since. There's another story about Hong Kong but and Japan. Good heavens. And of course Port Said happened. Again, we didn't know. I didn't know anything about it. We were never told anything. I think from memory, 6 weeks comes to mind. I don't know why. We were 6 weeks at sea, lying off Port Said. Because we learnt later that we were in trouble there.
Was this the Suez Crisis?
The Suez Crisis, yeah. I know we got down, we got no fresh veg, no fresh water. We were sort of no milk or nothing. We were eating corned beef and ship's biscuits. And we're using the water. What the water we had was distilled by the ship itself, so the fresh water tanks would have been empty. So it may well have been 6 weeks. It seems a long time to be at sea, especially on a British warship then. But again, I knew nothing of it. I was told that there was some trouble ashore, you know. Anything could have happened, you know.
What were the duties of the ship during the Suez Crisis?
No one ever told me. We just patrolled. We patrolled up and down, off Port Said. But what actually we did do, I've no idea. No one sort of said, well, this is what we're doing here, or this is where we are. But then you didn't ask. Orders were orders, and you carried them out, and that was it.
What kind of duties did you have on board?
Well, I started off as a boy seaman. Went up to ordinary seamen, so my duties then was seamanship duties, normally. That's right, I was on A-gun. I started off on A-gun, that's the first gun, right in the bows. We had single four fives on there, and the shell was separate from the cordite. The shell itself was 75 pounds, and the cordite was in a brass case. And the method of getting it into the barrel, into the chamber, breech, was put the shell in first into a tray, the cordite behind it, And then there was a wire rope with a T-handle on it, and two ratings on this T-handle pulled it. Well, that was my first job, on the other side of the T-handle. And I was ramming the shells and cordite up into the breech of the gun. I remember I was with a fella that big. I never put any pulling. He used to carry me. I used to hang onto this bloody handle and he'd carry me down. Then I got promoted. I got communications. I was inside the turret itself going round. Very exciting. And communications, I communicated with the director. That was the above the superstructure on the mast which directed the gun's fire. And I was also fuse setter. And on the anti-aircraft guns, there was a machine. I had to follow two pointers and keep them level. And that was the height at which the shells would explode. And, of course, on the end of the anti-aircraft shell was a movable piece which was connected to the dials. And the shell was put in the tray. I turned the handle, keeping the two pointers level, talking as well. So I had three jobs to go at. And fuse the shells, except that we had a radar type shell that had a glass end to it. That was a proximity detonator, that's right. You used to get in a certain distance of the aircraft and explode itself. But I went into B gun. That was a star shell gun. At night time, we fired star shell to illuminate the so-called supposed enemy. And I was on that for a while. But mostly, no, just seamanship duties, and that's what learning the ropes. It was a.
Was it a happy show?
Oh, good heavens, yes, yeah. It was. As I said, it was the atmosphere from the wartime. A lot of the men had been through the war, and that camaraderie, that it was all there still. Yeah, it was a good ship to be on, a good introduction into the Navy, or seagoing anyway. I think Ganges was the first introduction, but no, it was a good ship. We sailed right round the North Africa, all around the Greek islands, Cyprus, as I've said, Malta, very often to Malta, Gibraltar, fantastic site, Gibraltar, from the sea, and fantastic place, actually.
In what way?
The army occupied Gibraltar, and inside, where workshops, where whole vehicles could be assembled, disassembled, or whatever. There was freezers inside there, stores of food. Don't forget, this is before tourism. There was no tourism at all. And these places that I went to had been like that forevermore, hundreds of years. This is how they were meant to be. And it's a time, unfortunately, that will never come back. The places have changed that much with tourism. But I saw these places when they were as they had been. Gibraltar was a fantastic. It was a rock itself, I think the sight of it from sea. Above the horizon, you could see this huge rock sticking up, the shape of it. And you knew that, that was Gib, and you'd be there soon. You only had one street, Main Street. The Trocadero Bar, that's right, yeah. Oh, good heavens. The Trocadero Bar, first and last. Yeah. We got to the stage, we were in there that often, in the Trocadero Bar, that the girls, the bar girls, who also did flamenco dancing, they got quite friendly.